Welcome to the Karen Conti Show on 720 WGN.
Welcome in, everyone. It's Karen Conti being sandwiched between two different sports. We've got a half an hour to talk, and we're going to do the best we can to try to talk a little bit about some interesting things happening in Chicago. This week, history was made when our mayoral election resulted in two African-American women receiving the most votes. So now we know there will be a runoff election, but we know that we will have our first female mayor in Chicago. And the question is, how will a woman conduct herself differently in the office, or will she? Traditionally, how do women legislate and govern differently? A fascinating question. And here to discuss the issue with us is Dr. Jennifer Lawless. She has a PhD from Stanford in political science. She serves as the director of Women in Politics Institute and professor of government at American University. She's authored many books on the issue of gender and politics. Welcome to the show, Doctor. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. I do want to clear up, though. I left American University and the Women in Politics Institute in August, and I'm currently a professor at the University of Virginia.
Ah, I'm sorry. There you go. Okay. Well,
that's okay.
Another good school. And thank you for holding. I know that that we were scheduled for a little bit earlier, and I appreciate you holding on.
No worries.
And we also have with us in studio Joe Topinka, who is the son of Judy Barr Topinka, who, of course, was our beloved Illinois state treasurer and comptroller, and she was a state senator, and she served our state for many, many years, and she's one of the best females in office, and I am going to have Joe on as well. Hi, Joe. How are you?
Hi, Karen. Thanks for having me, and it's great to be with Dr. Lawless.
Hi. Okay, here we go. Let's talk a little bit about it. Generally speaking, Dr. Lawless, is there a difference between the way women govern and legislate than compared to men?
At this point in time, the answer is pretty much no, and that's because we've become so polarized as a country that we know almost everything there is to know about how somebody will vote, how they will engage with their colleagues, whether they'll co-sponsor legislation, who they'll meet with, who they'll travel with, who they'll go out on fact-finding missions with, based on whether there's a D or an R in front of that person's name. And so the upside to this dysfunction and this party polarization has actually been that in a lot of ways it's rendered the sex of a candidate moot. So the same way now that women are just as able as men to win elections, raise money, and garner fair press coverage, they're also very, very similar in the way that they legislate and govern.
Interesting, because I've read a little bit, and there's some talk in some of the publications that say that women are more collaborative and less confrontational when they legislate. They're better at negotiation and coalition building. Is that not true?
It might be true within the parties, and I can tell you that research I've conducted with colleagues finds that in Congress, women are more interested in building what we call school spirit or congressional school spirit. So they're more likely to go out with each other socially. They're more likely to participate in the congressional softball and baseball games, or to wear a seersucker suit on Seersucker Thursday, or to sign up for the Secret Santa gift exchange. So they do seem to place more of a premium on building friendships and relationships than their male colleagues do. The important thing, though, is that that doesn't seem to translate. So it's not to say that it's not important in and of itself to foster a collegial work environment, but we should not assume that that collegial work environment in any way leads to more negotiating, more bipartisanship, or more collaboration across the aisle.
Interesting, and I guess I would have thought that the old, it's like Chicago, you know, you have to kind of know Chicago, but there's an old boys network, and it's kind of been, we've had aldermen who have been in office for 50 years, and same old stuff. And so what we have now is the idea that we want someone new in there, and I think that both the candidates probably are bringing something new to the table. Is there some idea that women maybe don't blend into that old boys network as readily? I mean, we're kind of parsing the same issue, but could it be that they're going to be more of a maverick? Is there no gender difference when it comes to that?
There doesn't seem to be a gender difference there either, but let me say two things. The first is that all of the data analysis I've conducted focus on systematic patterns. It doesn't mean that there aren't individual exceptions. And at a time, in particular, a mayoral race where you've got two women, both of whom are now primed to be the first female mayor of Chicago, and a city with a history that suggests maybe it is time for a fresh face, new ideas, and somebody who's not part of what looks like this very male-dominated establishment, all of those factors could very well combine to generate a candidate and ultimately a mayor who does behave differently. So I don't want to suggest that we can just look at everybody else and make 100% accurate predictions about what's going to happen. Context certainly matters. But I do want to caution against having certain expectations simply because the mayor will be a woman.
Right. And I guess I should clarify, I guess Jane Byrne was our mayor many years ago. So I just wanted to, I said first African-American woman, because we've had an African-American mayor. I apologize for that. You know, Joe Topinka, I would like you to weigh in. Your mother was a politician back in the day when there were very few female politicians governing Illinois, and I think she always did a really good job of crossing the aisle. She was a Republican, but she got along with both sides and got a lot of things accomplished throughout her years. Do you see a difference in how your mother was treated back in that day and now how women are treated in local politics here in Illinois?
I recall when I talk about this in Just Judy, the book I wrote for young people, and you know, when she got to the legislature, the state house and the state senate, the big thing was there was no bathrooms for women, or what bathrooms were there were very limited. So the women were actually having to go into the public bathrooms in the Capitol to go use the bathroom because they weren't large enough. That was just one indicator. But yes, I think women were definitely treated differently. But in terms of what Dr. Lawless said, there's an individual exceptions. Yes, there is a time difference in terms of, you know, when my mother got into office and now with the data that Dr. Lawless presumably has. I think she was an individual exception, Karen. She was an individual exception, and she had the ability to cross the party lines, and she did it regularly.
Yeah. You know, let's take a break, and Dr. Laws, can you stay with us? I want to ask a few more questions.
Sure.
Okay, great. This, let's say we are going to this week on Chicago's Best. Get ready for the face-melting, sweat-inducing, belly-burning, but oh-so-tasty spicy. It's Chicago's Best Spicy, Sunday night at 10 o'clock on WGN-TV. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. Welcome back. It's Karen Conti. I'm here with Dr. Jennifer Lawless and here with Joe Topinka. Hi, Doctor. You're still there?
I am.
You are co-author of a book called It Takes a Candidate, Why Women Don't Run for Office. Why don't women run for office as often as men?
Two big reasons. The first is that they're less likely than men to receive encouragement to run, and that means they're less likely to receive formal messages of recruitment, formal invitations to become candidates from party leaders, elected officials, and political activists, but they're also less likely to receive encouragement and support from family members, colleagues, and friends. The second reason is they're less likely to think they're qualified, even when their resumes look exactly the same. So those two factors combined make it far less likely for women ever to think about throwing their hats into the ring, and then even when they've thought about it, far less likely to do it.
And is there a reason those are very interesting reasons, but is there a fundamental feeling that women just aren't tough enough, or they don't have the wherewithal, or that their primary that it's just a place that women don't belong? Is there some underlying current of that?
I think part of it has to do with the fact that we've surveyed and interviewed thousands and thousands of women and men now dating back to 2001. And when it comes to qualifications, women sense that they have to be twice as good to get half as far because politics remains a bastion of male dominance. And so they're not necessarily using the same yardstick as men. Men literally in our interviews told us things like, look, I look around and I see that my state senator is a moron. I must be just as good. Women were holding themselves up to these hypothetical standards that nobody could ever meet. And so that's based on this perception that when women run for office, they don't win. And it's really important that we begin to debunk that perception, because that would go a long way, not only in perhaps allowing women to recalibrate their expectations, but also in encouraging party recruiters to spend more time focusing on potential female candidates.
I see this a little bit in the workplace, Dr. Lawless, and I wonder if you have seen some of those stats. But I do see that, like, for instance, women have a hard time blowing their own horns in the workplace to say, hey, listen, this is what I've done for the company. This is what I've achieved. This is why I need a raise and a promotion. And women are almost perceived as bragging when they say that, whereas when men do that, they're just being men and they're being aggressive and they're doing the right thing. Is that somewhat what we're talking about here?
I don't think that that's the dynamic I'm describing. I'm not suggesting that that dynamic isn't accurate, but what we're seeing here instead is this perception that no matter how good they are, no matter how effective they are, no matter how compelling they're able to sell themselves as candidates, they sense that journalists won't take them seriously, donors won't write checks, voters won't vote for them. And as a result, unless they're uber, uber competent and confident, they don't give it a shot, whereas men figure, what's the worst that can happen? I'll lose this race.
Interesting. Now, men and women are held to different standards everywhere. That's just a fact. But in the political realm, how does that play out? You know, you see the, and again, to try to take politics out of it, you know, you see Hillary Clinton, and she was punished for Bill's affairs, but yet we have a president here who's been married a few times and has, you know, allegedly had issues with affairs with women. So it doesn't seem like he is as scathed by that as Hillary Clinton, just being associated with a man who did those things. Do we have double standards here?
Yeah, so it's difficult to figure out. There's no question that there are double standards. It's difficult as a social scientist to figure out how to measure it because we know, first of all, I want to be careful about not extrapolating from very, very unusual presidential contests to what it's like for the other 500,000 elected offices in this country. But to take the example that you gave, there's something to be said for the fact that Hillary Clinton was punished for her husband's affairs and Donald Trump was not. But it's also plausible, and the accounts of the Clinton campaign make this clear, that they didn't think that she would be the best attack dog against Donald Trump's womanizing and allegations of sexual assault because of her husband. So it's unclear if she was held accountable or if she wasn't able to attack because she feared that she would be associated with her husband. So it's very, you know, it's complicated. There's no question, though, that perceptions of a double standard certainly affect the way male and female candidates conduct themselves on the campaign trail, even if ultimately voters don't care. That's not to say voters don't care, but there is this self-selection phase where gender matters, and it probably matters a lot more there than by the time you make it onto the ballot.
Dr. Lowes, I know these are, you're a scientist, so you study statistics and you study these things, and these are not probably the easiest things to quantify because there's so much that is involved in people's opinions and why people like certain candidates or they don't. But is it, are women, can you tell, is there a way to judge how women are treated differently by the press than men? And is that something that you can measure?
We have measured mainstream print coverage for the 2010 and 2014 midterm elections pretty systematically. So we've looked at more than 11,000 newspaper articles and literally coded every mention of a candidate's spouse or parental status, every mention of his or her background, every mention of his or her appearance, and literally every single adjective or adverb used to describe the candidate and every issue associated with the candidate. So this is about 870 congressional districts over two elections. And we found nothing. No gender differences. The most interesting finding was that 96% of men and 95% of women received no mention of their appearance whatsoever, which flies in the face of what we would expect based on cable news coverage of very, very high-profile female candidates. So at the presidential level, there's unquestionably still differential coverage. But the really good news for the other positions in this country, even high-level congressional races, is that mainstream media and local print, which is still the place where most people get most of their news about local politics, tends to have moved to a time where, in terms of volume and content of coverage, men and women are faring equally well.
Interesting.
Karen, I will tell you that, you know, Mom used to tell me regularly, and this would explain so many of her clothes when she passed away. She used to tell me all the time that as a woman, she could not wear the same item day after day. There was an expectation that she had to wear something different. While a man could wear the same suit, maybe change a tie once in a while, but she would tell me regularly that the expectation was she had to wear something different, and she was treated differently and perceived that. And then she would tell me this, and recounting that.
And that's right. And that's the good, I think that's the good piece of information here. In the last decade or so, we've seen substantial change. Even studies of media coverage in the late 90s and early 2000s uncovered some differences, although they were becoming increasingly subtle. And so the fact that we've moved to a point right now where I can tell you, based on interviews with local newspaper reporters, that their sense is they don't want to be called out as sexist or holding women and men to different bars. They're going to censor themselves, I think, indicates a level of progress that we should be pretty happy with. Unfortunately, mainstream local newspapers are still the medium where journalistic norms matter the most. And so once you move outside of there, it's like the Wild West of journalism and anything goes. And there you see gender make its way into coverage all the time.
One final area I want to cover with you, Dr. Lawless, is we have one of our candidates, Lori Lightfoot, is the first openly gay mayoral candidate that we've had. She's married to her partner and they have a child. Is there some study on how that would impact voters' perception?
So we are still at a point in time where there are very, very few openly gay politicians. And we don't really have long-term systematic evidence. The good news at this point is that the studies that do exist suggest that the same way that gender and race, once you take into account the person's political party, don't seem to affect voter assessments, sexual orientation falls into that category as well. But, you know, I'm a little bit more tepid in summarizing that research just because it's newer and it's not as well established yet.
Karen, I will tell you, my mother was openly supportive of the gay and lesbian community, and some of her best friends were gay, lesbian, transgender. And, I mean, you know, when you think of a Republican in Illinois openly supporting the law that allowed for gay marriage, she was in the forefront.
She was ahead of her time. She was always marching in the gay parade.
That's correct.
And, you know, I hate to get on Facebook, arguments because you're going nowhere with that, but someone said something and I just had to weigh in and I said, you know, you're saying is as if, like, it would be bad to have a gay mayor. What are you actually saying, sir? And she started in by saying, well, she made a bad judgment by being a lesbian, so therefore she's going to make bad judgments as a mayor. And then I started, then I realized that conversation there's no conversation there. You know, I can't talk about that. If you feel that way, then you're going to feel that way. There's no changing it.
I will tell you, Judy Bartapinko would never say anything like that.
No. Dr. Lawless, where can people contact you? I know you've got some great books that look really, really interesting, Why Women Don't Run for Office, Running from Office, Why Young Americans Are Turned Off of Politics, and then you're the author of Becoming a Candidate, Political Ambition, and the Decision to Run for Office. All very, very interesting topics. Where can people get your books, and where can people contact you?
The books are all available on Amazon, and you can also contact me at jenlawless.com.
Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for holding on and waiting between all of our sporting events here in Chicago. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Take care. And Joe, I wanted to mention the Judy Bartapinko Charitable Foundation. It is a foundation. There's a scholarship, and you have a book that you wrote called Just Judy, A Citizen and Leader for Illinois. How can people pick up a copy of this book?
You can pick it up. Can go to judybartapinko.org for information, www.judybartapinko.org, or just go on to Amazon, and it's in Kindle. Some people like the Kindle because all the links work a lot better, but the book is so interactive, and as I tell a lot of students, it's like a treasure trove of 40 years of government, ethics, politics, you name it, from the last 40 years of this great state.
It's so great to see you, Joe. Take care.
Thanks,
Thank you, everyone, for listening. You're listening to WGN, The Karen Conti Show.